I think for me, debt and being able to raise money for a business is something that everybody should learn how to do. Everybody should should understand how to do, because there will be times where it's necessary. There'll be times when it can kind of supercharge, take you onto the next level. Best businesses and the most sustainable ones are the ones that can be a business without needing all that debt. That can bootstrap themselves in a certain way. And I think for me, any business owner who has leverage is somebody who has distribution. All of this distribution is really access to an audience.
Thank you so much for clicking on this episode of The Millennial Entrepreneur. The ambition of the podcast is to show relatable stories from young entrepreneurs doing some incredible things to inspire the next generation, including you listening wherever you are. We've been doing this podcast for over 3 years and the ambition has not changed. The only thing that has changed is the scale of where we want to go. We want to bring on bigger guests for you guys to show more and more relatable and inspiring stories from young entrepreneurs across the world. The majority of you guys listening haven't subscribed to the podcast yet. All you have to do is click that subscribe button wherever you're listening, on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and that will allow us to bring on bigger guests and ask the questions to them that you really want to hear. And it really is that simple. So thank you again for clicking on the podcast and enjoy the episode.
Amazing to have you on the podcast. How are you?
Good, buddy. Good. Thank you very much for having me.
My absolute pleasure. You're in Dubai at the moment, right?
I'm in Dubai, so a few hours ahead of the UK, although I'm still suffering the English working day at the moment.
Yeah. Would you say most of the business that you do is still based in the UK, or would you say it's like Middle Eastern orientated now?
No. All of my business really is in the UK. I came to Dubai about 2.5 years ago for lifestyle choices. I was a kind of a COVID refugee, and I tell a story that many English people do, which is kind of came here on a holiday and never went back again. But I did, I did leave an office and staff and everybody else back in the UK. So I was never looking to, rebuild here. I was just looking to kind of rehome and re-lifestyle. So I work English hours because I work on all my UK businesses. But my core business is lending money to businesses, lending money to SMEs in the UK. But we raise our money internationally. So I do a lot of raising here. And I also do a lot of networking just for kind of great people to have in the Rolodex, because I've never come across anywhere else in the world like Dubai, which has got such a high concentration of high caliber people. But my core business is still GBP denominated.
Yeah, I mean, like the whole Middle East, not only Dubai, is definitely like increased in popularity in terms of like tech, property. Like a lot of entrepreneurs have moved there because they are very forward thinking, right? So I mean, I've even considered it myself. Like, it looks very cool.
I mean, I recommend it to everybody. I mean, and I don't know anyone who doesn't tell a positive story about it. And I've got friends here who have come as billionaire entrepreneurs, multimillionaire entrepreneurs, employees in a business, self-employed people themselves, and everybody, whatever kind of level of the ladder or stage of the game. Loves their life, has great success in their own business, in their own field. And it's just, I think, I don't like UK bashing, because it feels like one of those things that we always moan about. But I do also feel over the last few years, it's gotten easier to become a UK basher, in terms of...
I fully agree with you, yeah. I fully agree with you.
The mentality so negative and backward, the crime and it's just puts you in a bad mood before you start, whereas everybody over here is very, very growth orientated. It's it's abundance, not scarcity. It's safe, it's clean, and everybody wants to help each other as well.
But I would love to jump into your journey, because your journey is a very interesting one, where you had success very young, and then you had bankruptcy, and then now you said you moved to Dubai, and then you lend SMEs money, and then you do some investment as well. So it's a very cool journey to dig into. So I guess before we do, like, where did it all begin for you?
I mean, my entrepreneurial journey began in my very early teens, really. Insofar as I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and knew I wanted to be in business. My only real driver for that at the time was because I think in the early 90s, we lived under this kind of notion that the only way to make big money was to own your own business. I think that, coupled with the fact that my dad did have his own business as well, so the entrepreneurial spirit was in the household. So I knew I wanted to be in business, and I spent my teenage years trying everything possible to make money, you know, from buying and selling things at the market, to squatting on domain names, to, you know, being a table magician in a local Italian restaurant. My first kind of proper business was working in a family business from kind of 18 to 21. It was a failing business where I kind of got to get stuck in to, you know, every possible problem a business owner could ask for, you know, suppliers that didn't want to supply us, customers that didn't want to deal with us, banks who wanted to pull the plug, every kind of financial and operational problem you could imagine. And I left there when I was 21, 22 to move into leisure. Again, I wasn't particularly qualified for it, but I thought the only qualification I needed was the fact that I was young and knew how to drink, and thought that if I owned a bar, all that money that came across the till would be mine, and I could drink beer, meet girls, and get paid for it at the same time. That really was all it took for me to want to be a bar owner, which I did for a couple of years to kind of varying degrees of unsuccess. But my first big hit, if you like, was when I was about 23. I was in the early stage of being 23, and I opened a strip club back in Wakefield, and I kind of decided to take the positives of the leisure business, find a solution to some of the failings, which was really lack of gross margin and lack of other income streams other than selling alcohol itself, and that opportunity presented itself in the strip club industry, and I opened a venue when I was 23 in March 2004, which hit the ground running really, I think part good planning, part good timing. But it really was a success from the outset. And I then really kind of fast forward 4 years. Over the next 4 years, I opened 11 strip clubs. I was the biggest strip club operator in the UK. I had 65 bars and pubs. I had a property group. I had retail stores. And I'd also started a small finance book at that time, lending money to other businesses as well. I kind of learned to become a lender by being a borrower, because all of those businesses that I kind of mentioned there, you know, I grew them off the back of learning by accident, really, how to borrow money. I mean, when I opened that first strip club, I didn't know the first thing about borrowing money. I didn't even really know there was a place other than a bank to go to that you could borrow from. And I got introduced to what nowadays we call alternative lenders, before the word alternative lender even existed. But what it did mean was that, you know, that empire, if you like, was built on sand and a house of cards, and it was absolutely leveraged to the hilt with very expensive, very short term debt. I think as people have learned over the last few years that, you know, when money's easy, in easy supply, and lenders are lending, you know, you can mask many problems. And really, that's what I did unknowingly for 4 years. And when the credit crunch of 2008 started, the rug was pulled from under us. You know, we didn't have the capital base to support it. Our lenders weren't prepared to work with us. August, September 2008, when I was 27, lost a lot overnight. It really was. When I say overnight, you know, maybe it wasn't overnight. Well,
like,
it really wasn't.
Let me just interrupt you very quickly. So how did you actually lose that? How did you lose that overnight, as you said? Like, because, yeah, 2008 happened, like, but you still had a successful chain of clubs, right? Like, so what went wrong?
Everything was successful in terms of turnover. Most things were successful in terms of profitability, but what none of them were very good at was producing cash, because they were all bought or grown using very short term, very expensive money. So, you know, let's say as an example, let's say it cost me £500,000. To buy and refurbish and open a strip club, and let's say that venue made £150,000 profit. You know, you take those two numbers, that's quite a nice return on investment. But if that £500,000 that I had to fit it out with, if I was paying that back over, say, 3 years, and, you know, with an interest rate of X, you know, all of a sudden the cash flow needed to pay that lender was more than the profit. And I guess, you know, it's something I probably didn't appreciate at first, and then was too deep in, and had to keep treading on the wheel. And it's something that, you know, I've been a lender now and been on the other side of the table, I see day in, day out that, you know, that business owners absolutely do not appreciate the difference between profit and cash flow. And I may have been making £150,000 a year of profit on that club, but I need, you know, but I had £250,000 of, let's say, balance sheet issue. And that was basically, in simple terms, that was the problem on each of the venues. And as we opened the next one and maybe produced a bit more cash, it could mop up the first one's problem. And we went on the third one and it mopped up the second one's problem. But it was a treadmill. It was an unsustainable hamster wheel that was only working whilst people were prepared to continue to lend to us. And I guess I talk about it now and you look back on those days in terms of, you know, what it was kind of obvious stupidity, but I mean, I think it's very easy for people to say, you know, from the outside in, you know, when you can see the wood from the trees. I mean, I was, you know, 24 when I'd started this journey. I'm not making any excuses for myself at all, but, you know, I didn't know any better. And I guess I was also blinded by the fact that all these hungry lenders were, or greedy lenders were keen to lend to me. Therefore, I was keen to borrow and it was, when it was going good, it worked for us all. You know, that they lent and made money, I borrowed and made money. There was a plan in place, which was that, you know, once we'd achieved X amount of turnover, built a business of a certain size, it was going to get refinanced by a mainstream institution. And that was the kind of, let's say, the annoyance of it, if you like. But when I was paying all that debt back over 3 years, it was totally unsustainable. Should we move that to 7, 8, 9, 10 years, it would be actually very, very cash generative. And we had agreements in principle to do that with two or three lenders. But by the time we'd got ourselves into the shape to be able to actually go and take the money off those lenders, the credit crunch had started. They'd lost their appetite. And unfortunately, you know, we didn't have a way out and had to go back to negotiate with the lenders that we had. And it was just a hole that was too deep to negotiate out of. So when I say lost a lot overnight, you know, the word overnight is a slight exaggeration, but, you know, it really was as quick as in a matter of weeks. And, you know, I've kind of, you know, since then I've heard the expression many times that, you know, when somebody went bankrupt, they go, how did that person go bankrupt? And, you know, the kind of, you know, humorous response, if you like, is at first very slowly and then very quickly. And really that is how it works. And I'm, you know, trying to think quickly off the top of my head of what let's say a non-financial analogy would be, but I guess it would be, I don't, you know, almost like, you know, running a water into a bottle that, you know, when the bottle's got a narrow neck and, you know, it's going down, it feels slow. As it gets to the top, all of a sudden it's like glug and spills over.
I was going to say, Matt, do you think a similar thing is happening now where people were, not as bad as 2008 for sure, because there were, you know, things have changed, I think, in terms of structures, but like people were very close, like used to like very cheap credit. And also to a point where a lot of venture capital firms were giving out money for, like, frankly, not very great ideas just because credit was very cheap. And so you had a situation where a lot of businesses were being invested in. And now it's a situation where me as a business owner, I've got a SaaS business, as people know, I'm trying to raise investment fairly soon for it. And, you know, I've been told by a lot of like founder friends of mine that the situation now is it's very difficult to raise money. But I guess, are they just comparing it to maybe the last like a few years where credit was like very, very cheap?
I mean, there's probably a couple of different questions and a couple of different answers in there. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, raising equity versus raising debt, then, you know, then equity is always a tougher gig to raise than debt. And particularly now, you know, with people being cautious and, you know, events over the last kind of 3, 6, 12 months, you know, raising equity is much harder than it was. But going to what I thought your first question was going to be, that, you know, how does now, i.e. 2022-23, differ to 2008? And you were saying it's not as bad as. I would say the situation now is 10 times worse, or will be 10 times worse than it was back in 2008. But it's just been masked for longer. I mean, you know,
In terms of what?
Well, I guess in terms of the balloon that's blowing, you know, waiting to burst at some point, and I guess, you know, the longer it's prolonged for, you know, the bigger the bubble is to burst. And really, you know, I mean, we're talking about it now in, say, 2023. From 2019, this problem had been going on for 4, 5, 6 years, you know, but probably a year or two too long at that point. And there was many, many zombie businesses. There's many, many individuals who were over leveraged with the personal credit. And really, they were all due to go, you know, to go pop around, you know, kind of 2018, 19, certainly by 2020. And And then, you know, when COVID started to happen, everybody thought, well, that is the writing on the wall. That is the point that these people are definitely now going to hit a wall, because they've been living on easy credit. They've been, you know, they've been robbing Peter to pay Paul. And now that's, you know, now the turnover is going to stop. Then they're all gonna go bust. But then, you know, we got the absolute opposite effect in COVID because of all the bounce back loans, quantitative easing, concessions that were given to people. And there's just been, I guess, other, let's say, macroeconomic events that have continued since then, which, for whatever reason, have all meant that more money's been put into the system or more problems have been protracted. And so I think for me, it's been easier than ever for these businesses to continue to survive. You know, businesses that just shouldn't exist. You know, people that have found it very easy to call themselves entrepreneurs because they have been a business owner, but you know they would have been infinitely more profitable working for somebody else, because you know they've got businesses that aren't really businesses. You know, they aren't business owners, but they've been able to. You know,
it's more like jobs that they've created for themselves.
Exactly, and join the dance by that availability of easy credit. Now, look, I can't tell you whether the rug's going to be pulled in 3 months or 12 months or 3 years or whatever, but it has to go. I think when it does go, it will fall a hell of a lot further than it did back in 2008.
But so bringing it back to, I guess, like people listening, a lot of, as I said to you before, audiences, you know, around like early 20s, late 20s, some people at school, even like university. So in terms of like the next generation of entrepreneurs going into this climate, as you just described, like what can they do to sort of, I guess, you know, be prepared for this? And also the other angle of like what opportunities exist now that perhaps wouldn't have existed if this climate wasn't there.
You can argue debt both ways, and it's a good thing and a bad thing. I think for me, debt and being able to raise money for a business is something that, you know, everybody should learn how to do. Everybody should, you know, should understand how to do, because there will be times where it's necessary. There'll be times when when it can kind of supercharge you and, you know, take you on to the next level. I think, you know, really the best businesses, you know, and the most sustainable ones are the ones that can be a business without needing all that debt, you know, that can bootstrap themselves in a certain way. And I think, you know, for me, any business owner who has leverage is somebody who has distribution, and you know, whether that is you know, well, I say all of this distribution is really access to an audience. And we were just talking a bit, you know, off camera before we started, about, you know, I guess what would I be advising to kids of today? You know, I've got a 1 week old and a 16, 17 year old. I think, you know, for me, what they've got that I didn't have, and you know, I still like to consider myself not old, but as young as I think I am, I grew those businesses in an era before social media, before crowdfunding, before alternative lending, and I'm not going to say the internet was in its infancy, because it certainly wasn't in its infancy, but it was 5 or 6 or 7 years old as opposed to 27 years old. And what anyone going into business has got today is the ability to be able to do something at such scale that you know, we never had 20 years ago. So I think, you know, my advice to, you know, to any young entrepreneur, it's really to find a way to own and control that distribution. You know, whether it's through mailing lists, whether it's through partnerships, whether it's through you know, social media. But you know, if you control the distribution, you know, you can build a sustainable high margin business in any market condition. I think, you know, when you see the, you know, the big people, when you see business owners hitting it big, you know, with big numbers. Whether that's a Zuckerberg with a Facebook, or a, you know, or The Rock with his tequila, you know, these people, for slightly differing reasons, it's all about being able to do something at scale and having distribution to the masses. And look, you know, debt's great. The ability to raise money is great, to be able to sprinkle in there at times, but I think it's just been used for too long as a mask on the truth, really, and people almost think that the ability to raise money constitutes profit in itself.
You talk about debt quite a bit, and then like when you say the question around like equity, and you say it's very difficult. It's more difficult to raise equity now than it is debt. You mentioned. So,
well, I think it's more difficult now, but it's I say it's more difficult in general, really. I may say that because I come from a debt space. I mean, look, if someone spends all day raising equity, they might tell you it's more easy to raise equity than it is debt. But I think, you know, the reason I find equity, why I find debt easier to raise, and why I believe anyone would, is because debt is normally a much more simpler and quantifiable proposition. You know, I'm going to lend you £100,000. You're going to pay me £20,000 interest. You're going to give me £120,000 back. This is your business with your cash flow, how you're going to pay it back. And this is the piece of security, if appropriate, of what I'm going to take if it all goes wrong. You know, it's three or four or five very tangible, quantifiable variables that most people can understand. When it comes to raising equity, there's just so many other things that come into play. The success of the business, the quality of the management team, the ups and downs of the market, and you could argue that some of those have an impact on the debt as well, and they do. But if you're a secured lender, which I am, and which, you know, many other, I guess, lenders are in their own different ways of taking security. If the business has its downs, well, you've still got something tangible that you're going to take. So it's, and also then when it comes to raising equity, you know, you need to be talking to people who've got a specialism and understanding of that. You know, you mentioned your SaaS business, and that's great if you're talking to SaaS investors, people with that knowledge. But, you know, if you're raising money for a bar, you need people who understand bars. If you're raising money for biotech, you need people who understand that. And it's just a much, much harder game.
Would you say, I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but just for people listening, like the, whether it would be debt or equity, would you say it depends on obviously like the business model of what you're trying to do? As you said, like a strip club or a bar, given that they're more cash flow, like they're going to generate cash flow quicker than say a SaaS business, because you need to put time into development, and there's more risk in terms of like, will businesses actually buy a SaaS, whereas bars like very established, like debt probably makes more sense in that space, whereas equity probably makes more sense in the SaaS space.
I mean, it's gonna depend on the timing of the business. You know, like you said, the stage of the business at, you know, whether it's generating cash, etc. I mean, if you're a new start business, or an early stage business, then you've got no revenues, or you may have revenue, but you probably won't have profit, and certainly won't have cash flow to pay that debt. And, you know, many business owners, or many, you know, let's say particularly naive business owners, will want to concoct a way that they can say, well, okay, we can only pay you a small bit back now and a bigger bit back later. But, you know, ultimately that's not how it works as a lender. And you know, lending money really is about simplicity, predictability, security, and that is exactly what investing in a business from an equity perspective isn't. Now, again, it's not that one's right and one's wrong, because, you know, you invest in debt and the returns will be relatively low, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12%. You can invest in equity and you can get 100x your money. But then, you know, for every one that gets you 100x, you've got, you know, 45 other deals that lose you money, and, you know, four or five that are making you 2, 3, 4, 5 times. So, like I said, it's not that one's right and one's wrong. It's ultimately, you know, what do you know? What do you understand? I think, you know, but if you're going to invest successfully in equity, you have to have a very mixed portfolio, a very large mixed portfolio. And, you know, other than the 1 in a million lucky people, you know, anyone who tells you about, you know, a 100x return they've got will also have plenty of stories of absolute write-offs to tell you, whereas in debt.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that you're 100% right. And that's actually like how the business model of like a venture capital firm is structured, right? Like they know that that's going to happen. So that's why they invest in like multiple different businesses. So for a venture capital to invest in you, you're not entirely like special, unfortunately, because they invest in so many different types of businesses in, say, a niche like AI or Web3 or whatever. Like, just because they think that industry is going to take off, and you might be one of, say, 20 investments that hopefully one of you does make 100x, because that will cover the other 19 that don't do that.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's just a completely different mindset as that venture capitalist, you know, like as someone in a debt space, you know, you're looking for something very, very, let's say, simple and predictable, and, you know, and almost like, let's say, guaranteed quantities of someone who can perform. You know, sometimes, you know, you look at businesses that have raised venture capital or had equity put into them, and you think, how the hell did that lunatic, you know, with that non-existent idea, go and raise 10 million? And I can't even get someone to lend me 50 grand for my, you know, for my business that's got 10 years of history. And the reality is, or the answer is, because that venture capitalist may think that guy's a lunatic, but they think, I don't care if he's a lunatic, because I've got 20 million to deploy here, and I'm putting a million into 20 different businesses. And if that, and I know I'm going to lose 15 of them. So if I lose 15 on a lunatic who could shoot for the moon, then fine, I lose it on that lunatic. But, you know, I'll have one that makes the money. And yeah, it's just a very different game.
Very true. The question I want to end the podcast with, Matt, it's been so good having you on, and I think you must have thought about this question before, but say if you were to start from scratch today, or like you put yourself back like a few years where you don't have anything and you're in 2023 right now, what would you be doing? Like, what's the sort of business you'd be running? How would you be running it? What's the structure? Like, who would you be going to? Have you thought about that?
I mean, I wouldn't say I've thought about what sector I would go into today, because I think the best sector for me to advise anyone to go into is the sector that they understand the best. Now, you know what, that may be a sector that's got a ceiling compared to something else. But, you know, I think the benefits of getting it right in a sector that you understand far outweigh the benefits of getting it wrong in a sector that you don't understand. And, you know, like, for example, I always say I'm not really a tech guy. I'm absolutely not a biotech guy, and some of these. And yes, that means that it precludes me from some really big returns, but it also saves me from you know, plenty of losses, because they would be losses, because I'd just be getting the wool pulled over my eyes left, right, and center. So I think sector, I always say I'm sector agnostic, and you know, I'm agnostic to anybody else's sector, because you know, if they understand it, then that's good for them. I think the things I would do different to what I'd done, say, 20 years ago, is approach things with less ego of wanting to own and control absolutely everything. And I've really learned over the last few years to value quality partners. You know, and if you'd have asked me, you know, 20 years ago, it was all very much about, you know, I've got to be the big guy, I've got to own 100% of all the equity. You know, I would happily pay other people money, but I would never, you know, I didn't want partners. I didn't want to be thought of as anything less than above someone else and 100%. But if you ask me now, I'll happily take. You know, small pieces of lots of pies with lots of different partners, as long as those are the right partners, you've got things to bring to the table, because you know, there's so much more scope to grow quicker. And you know, we were talking earlier on this podcast about the power of distribution, and for me, yeah, to be able to fast track what I want, you know, by being able to distribute through other partners, or by having other partners who've got access to something I haven't got. You know, that's what I'd do. That would save me a lot of pain, and that would make my journey a lot quicker.
I think that's an excellent bit of advice. I think, like, you do still see that, like, it's a very personal thing that, yeah, I think I had it as well, especially is like, I want to be doing everything, like control every element of the business. And what you physically can't, but also it's not efficient for you to be doing that, because there's people that have expertise in certain areas that you just don't. And it's better for you to focus on the areas of the business that you have expertise in, because that will just lead to more profitable outcomes in the long term. Why did you think that back then you were like that? Do you think it's like a vanity thing that people like deal with?
I mean, I would say vanity undoubtedly, but I think really it's because I didn't know any better. You know, and I think one of the areas I've been, you know, other people would look at me as being unfortunate, and I'd say I've been remarkably lucky, is to have so many failures and mistakes and cock-ups along the way, because, you know, you only learn from the things that go wrong. I think, you know, particularly when it comes to business, particularly when it comes to finance, you know, when things go right, it's very easy to try and pat yourself on the back and think you're amazing because you had a great plan in place and that's why it went right. When you never really know if that's the case, but when things go wrong, you get to look at why they went wrong. You get to be able to dissect them and unravel them and make sure you don't make that mistake again. But unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, when people have catastrophic events in business, it's, you know, they either never have it or they have it once and it's never to be repeated. And I've been, like I say, you know, inverted commas, lucky that I've had so many of these catastrophic events that I've learned so much, you know, at a young age. And I guess a big part of my business model now is helping other people not make the mistakes. I mean, you know, whether that's, you know, helping from an altruistic level because I might be making content on social media, or helping from a personal profit level because I can partner with these businesses, lend to these businesses and show them the error of my ways and where I went wrong. So yeah, well, listen, vanity always comes into play, but really I just didn't know any better and I didn't have anyone to teach me.
Well, I guess that's a good message to end on in terms of, well, yeah, if you don't know any better, then if you listen to this podcast, then now you do know better. And the vanity thing, you definitely know, if it is a vanity thing, then that's something you need to work on, because that definitely holds you back, I would say, in success longer term.
I mean, it doesn't, like I said, you know, with the whole partnership thing and stuff, you know, it's the kind of, it's the vanity of thinking that, you know, I know better than you, or, you know, I don't want to share anything with you, and there's no logic to it. It's just purely vanity driven.
Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on the podcast. It's such a pleasure having you on. How can people stay in touch with you and what you're doing?
So I have a podcast myself as well, which is the Matt Haycock Show. And I'm also on all things social. I am the Matt Haycock. So that's TheMattHaycock. I have a newsletter that hangs off my website, which is matt-haycocks.com. So follow me on social, subscribe to my newsletter, check out my podcast. And if you've got any questions, if you've got any problems and you want me to stop you making your mistakes, then drop me a line and I'll help you remove that vanity.
All right, perfect. Thank you so much, my friend. And yeah, I'm sure we'll speak very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.